Hi, this is Father Bill W. here in Austin, Texas. I want to welcome you back to the podcast. I am an Episcopal priest in long-term recovery, celebrated 48 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous not too long ago. And want to invite you, if you have not done so already, please visit our website. It's entitled Two-Way Prayer, and it teaches a form of prayer and meditation that they used to do in early AA. And some reason that thing got lost, and it's really an important piece if you want to understand some of the background of our 11th step. Also, doing workshops on that two-way prayer. We're doing them monthly now through June, so if you haven't attended one of those, please try to do so. Second Saturday of each month, 10 to about 12:30, 1 o'clock Central Time. Drop me a line at twowayprayer@gmail.com, and I will be happy to send you a flyer on that with the codes that you're going to need. It's a Zoom workshop, and we'll also sign you up for our monthly newsletter at the same time. I'm excited now. We're starting a new series, and it's going into a book. I'm basing this on the work of a Jungian therapist. His name was Edward Edinger. And he wrote a book called Ego and Archetype. And Edinger was a Jungian therapist, founder of the Jung Institute in New York City. And I first read this book, gosh, it must be almost 30 years ago now. And I will never forget, the profound impact that it had on me, because it answered questions about some stuff that I had an inkling of that was going on inside, but heck, I didn't even know how to ask the questions about some of the material that this thing started touching. And it was, I think it was my first window into what some Jungians call the inner world. And I knew it had something very, very important to teach me. So I was close to 20 years sober at the time. And I've read this book since then, probably gone back to it 5 or 6 times. And each time I understand it a little bit more, and teaches me more about me and more about what my first sponsor used to call the human condition. A little tough to get a handle on that one. And what I hope to do in this series is take us through several of Edinger's chapters and try my very best to break them down, see how the concepts and the ideas he describes might be of help to those of us in recovery. Now, you don't really need to buy the book for this series. But there is a link to a free copy of it that you might want to tag along and look at it. I'm going to put it in the show notes, and so it's free. It's a PDF version, and so God is good and God is thrifty. So chapter one is titled "The Inflated Ego." That one grabbed my attention right away, and I think those of us who are alcoholics and addicts should identify with that title and get us interested in the topic. Edinger begins by introducing Jung's concept of something that he calls the self. Jung calls it the self, and he spells that self with a capital S. So there's a small s self, and there's a large s self. And this is not an easy concept to grasp. And I think actually Jung was toying with it, trying to grab a hold of something many, many years ago that he sensed was there, but had a real difficult time putting a name on it. And this was the best one he could come up with. So what Jung discovered is basically this, that while the human ego is the center of our unconscious mind, that is not that we are all made up of. We also have an unconscious mind, and that unconscious part of us is actually the greater and the far larger and even the more controlling part of our minds. And what Jung discovered is that there's another center in our minds, a center that includes both the conscious and the unconscious. And it's that center that he calls the self. So to kind of maybe understand this, think of an iceberg. And the conscious mind is the top part of that iceberg, the part that we can see. And this represents the ego. And ego is simply Latin, and it simply means I. It's my sense of I. It's my sense of who I am. But, you know, with the iceberg, we know that there's more to that iceberg, because maybe 90% or more of the iceberg we cannot see. And the same is true for the unconscious part of our mind. So we cannot see that either. But it can have a huge effect on us. And that effect can be both to the good and to the bad. So getting back to the human ego and its relationship to this self, let me repeat that while the ego is the center of our conscious mind, the self is the center of both the conscious and the unconscious. You might call it the life force within us, the great reality within. And I think that's exactly what Edinger is starting to talk about. And he says probably the most important thing, the most vital thing, is that the ego is rightly related to this self. Now, Edinger uses some terms and themes that people have used to describe this self, and he lists some of them. He says it is wholeness, totality. It's the union of opposites. It's the creative point where God and man meet. Robert Johnson refers to it as the Christ mind, the Buddha mind. Edinger, the point where transpersonal energies flow into personal life. He calls it the elixir of life. And one other scholar says it's all that we are, but at the same time, it is also all that we could be. So it's our potential as well as our deepest reality. And that self is pushing us, prompting us, wanting us to become fully who we are capable of being. I'm pretty convinced in two-way prayer, that's the voice that we are listening to. It's not the ego voice. It's that other voice. You can call it God, or you can maybe call it the self, like Edinger does. So anyway, all of these Edinger say all of these concepts refer to the self. So here's the way he sums it up. The self is the central source of life energy, the fountain of being, which is most simply described as God. Indeed, the richest sources for the study of the self are in the innumerable representations that man has made of the divinity. So Jung isn't saying that the self is God, but he is saying that it is a reflection of God, an image, the image of God. And first and foremost, you got to remember Jung is a scientist. And he says, in effect, I can't talk about God. That's not my field. But I can talk about the image of God that people have in their minds. I can talk about that. I can even study that, and I can see the effects when the relationship between the ego and the self is right, when it's flowing, and when it's in good order. And I can see it when it is not. So a therapist in my early sobriety used to ask me when I'd come see him, he'd say, "Hey, Bill, how's your love life?" And he didn't mean who was I dating or how was my sex life going at the time. The question was, how's your love life? Are you getting in touch with a new center inside of you? A center that is life-giving, life-affirming, a center that's bringing love into you and receiving love back from you? Is love and service to the self, in effect, becoming your code? Is God everything, or is God nothing? What's the connection like? Now, this relationship between the ego and the self, it goes through a number of changes over the course of our lives. And you might also say it goes through a number of changes during the course of any one day. Are we connected or are we not? And in time, I think we learn to kind of take our spiritual pulse. And that's a really important thing to do. Am I connected? Is God's life flowing through me? Or is my ego really taking control once again? Jung makes a big deal about the two halves of life. And he says that in the first half of life, our work is initially to build up an ego. And then the rules change, because in the second half of life, our work is to begin letting that ego go, to reduce the size of that ego that we had worked so hard to build up. I mean, life is not easy. Human life is very difficult. So here's Jung's quote on this. He says, "The first half of life is devoted to forming a healthy ego. The second half is going inward and letting go of it." We'll come back to that. So how do we first form this ego? Well, Edinger starts off with the infant, and he starts where we all start, in the womb. And he's looking at consciousness here. What is the consciousness, the awareness the individual, the child, the adult, what is the nature of that awareness? So in the womb, let's see, what happens there? You know, all of the ego's needs are met. So what he says is that consciously at that stage, when we are in the womb, there really is no separate ego. Because the ego and the self, with a capital S, are really joined. It's really one. It's a sense of unity that the infant, that the child, that the baby has in utero. And all of the ego's needs are met. It's merged with the self. And if it were truly conscious, it might perceive itself as one with God. Couldn't really think that way, but everything is taken care of. There's no sense of separate self. And then comes what you might call the first birth, entry from the world where all is right and wonderful into a world where separation and ultimately, and actually pretty quickly, suffering begins. Suffering begins. But remember, it remembers, rather, another world. And that remembrance is deep in the unconscious. And here Edinger quotes the poet William Wordsworth, and you might remember this from high school, I did. Wordsworth writes, "Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting, the soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar. Not in entire forgetfulness, and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy." Now, the child fully equates itself with God. It's about to begin the human journey, the journey of forming an ego. And Edinger says this, it's a lovely quote. He says, "The self, capital S, is born, but the ego is made. In the beginning, all is self." So remembering and identifying with its godlike status, the ego begins in what Edinger calls, in this first chapter, a state of inflation. So it's starting off on the wrong foot, so to speak. So what is inflation? Edinger quotes the dictionary. He says, "The dictionary definition of inflation is blown up, distended with air, unrealistically large and unrealistically important, beyond the limits of its proper size, hence to be vain, pompous, presumptuous." He continues, "I used the term inflation to describe the attitude and the state which accompanies the identification of the ego with the self. It is a state in which something small, the ego, has aggregated to itself the qualities of something larger, the self, and hence is blown up beyond the limits of its proper size. We are born in a state of inflation. So the ego is not the problem. See, we have to have an ego. And this is a mistake I hear so often in 12-step recovery. I got to get rid of my ego. Well, if you get rid of your ego, you're going to be psychotic. You have to have an ego. The point is the ego has to be the right size. It has to be humble and teachable. And it has to be rightly related to this deeper self. Hey? So the problem is when the ego, unconsciously, of course, equates itself with God and therefore makes itself an equal to God. So when the big book says we had to quit playing God, I think this is the kind of thing that it's referring to. And when it says the problem is self, that's also what it means. The problem is not just I'm a little bit selfish. The problem is that I have taken on a disproportionately large sense of self and in effect am challenging the true self, the God self that is within. So the question in recovery isn't how do I get rid of my ego, but it's how does my ego become rightly related to the higher power or the self? Here's Edinger. The child experiences himself quite literally as the center of the universe. The mother at first answers that demand. Hence, the initial relationship tends to encourage the child's feelings that its wish is the world's command. And it is absolutely necessary that this be so. If the constant and total commitment of the mother to the child's need is not experienced, the child cannot develop psychologically. However, before long, the world necessarily begins to reject the infant's demands. At this, the original inflation begins to dissolve, being untenable in the face of experience. But also, alienation begins. The ego-self axis is damaged. We're going to talk a lot about that ego-self axis. And what that means is the link, the connecting line between the small self and the greater self. That line gets broken, okay? And a kind of unhealthy psychic wound, Edinger says, is created in the process of learning he is not the deity, the God he thought he was. He is exiled from paradise, and permanent wounding and separation occur. So oftentimes when you get into therapy, the therapist will take you back to childhood events, some back really, really early, because that's where the damage gets done. This link is so vital. And if it gets disturbed, we're gonna suffer the consequences of that for the rest of our lives. So I want you to visualize a link, like a line of communication. And this is a way for power, as well as for meaning and purpose, to flow into us from the higher self to the smaller ego self. If they're connected, power and life can flow. If they are severed, cut, look out. How do I begin to feel then? Try restless, irritable, and discontent. Edinger goes on. Repeated experiences of alienation continue progressively right into adult life. One is constantly encountering a twofold process. On the one hand, we are exposed to the reality encounters which life provides and which are constantly contradicting unconscious ego assumptions. This is how the ego grows and separates from its unconscious identity with the self. At the same time, we must have recurring reunion between ego and self in order to maintain the integrity of the total personality. Otherwise, there is a very real danger that as ego is separated from the self, the vital connecting link between them will be damaged. If this happens to a serious extent, we are alienated from the depths of ourselves, and the ground is prepared for psychological illness. And what happens, of course, is we carry those ego inflations over into our adult life. Edinger looks at some of these ego inflations, and I'm sorry to do this, but I know this is going to hurt a little bit. So it always hurts me. It's going to be painful. But this is how we take on these godlike characteristics, unaware that that's really what we're doing. So he says, what are some of these ego inflations? So he says, well, how about spells of anger, where I'm experiencing or taking on myself the wrath of God? See, that wrath better stay with God, but I take it on. Urges to seek vengeance. Edinger quotes, "A vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." Thinking of oneself as all powerful. That's God's omnipotence. Intellectual rigidity. The know-it-all. I know it all. That's God's omniscience. And it's very important to understand that there's also a thing called negative inflations. And these are just as destructive, or maybe even more so, than the positive ones. But they are a little trickier to grab a hold of. Some examples. No one in the world is as guilty or as bad as I am. Do you have a critic in your mind who talks to you like that? I mean, I had for years, and he still appears. He still shows up, you know? I had a therapist say to me, early recovery, he said, "Hey, Bill, if somebody said to you the things you say to you about yourself, what would you do to that guy?" And I said, "I'd kill him." And he said, "Good morning." And that was when I first started to see some of this inner stuff that's going on inside of me. I mean, our addictions oftentimes really are a form of suicide, eh? It may be okay for you to screw up. Here's another one. And these underlying assumptions there, you're an idiot, you know, but me, I should have known better. And that's inflation as well. I can forgive you, but I will not forgive me. That is inflation. And many of us kind of swing wildly from thinking I'm the best thing that ever came along in God's green earth, and I'm the worst piece of slime, and I want to crawl under a rock. We are extremists, and our moods shift back and forth between those two. We got to watch them. Either way is an inflation. The highs and the lows of recovery. Hey, it's no wonder a lot of us wind up with a diagnosis of manic depressive. We're on a roller coaster, particularly the first few years in recovery. I want to hit on two more points, and then I'm going to finish up. And this is important, and we're going to go deeper into this as we move into some of the other chapters. But Jung saw that it was primarily through our myths and through our sacred stories that we learned and passed on some of these terribly important human truths that the human condition has to deal with. And you see, we've only known about the unconscious for a little over 100 years, but we've known about the human condition for thousands. And these insights come down to us through myths and stories. And this Jung called the collective unconscious, because the stories were similar. from culture to culture, even though people never had an opportunity to share those with one another. So that's the archetype. Two quick samples. First is the well-known one. It's the Hebrew story, the Jewish story of Adam and Eve. And I want you to try to think of that, maybe for the first time, as a psychological inflation story that's trying to be communicated. Hey, so there they are, Adam and Eve in the garden, happy, naked, and free. Hey, all their needs are met, it's like being in the womb. And they are in union with the self. God comes strolling through the garden in the cool of the evening and talks to them. How you doing, Adam? How you doing, Eve? The juice is flowing. It's fine. But they want more, see? They want to be like God. They want to take on godly powers. That's the whole point of the story. They want to be the self. You can be in relationship to the self, but you cannot try to be the self. It's a very subtle distinction. So they succumb to that temptation. And when they do, what happens? They break the connection with the self, with God. And they experience guilt for their action. They experience shame. Scripture says they notice for the first time that they were naked. I hadn't been even aware of that. Something has come into human consciousness. And what is it? It's separation from the link, the very, very important link that connects me with the source of life. Now, actually, this rebellion isn't all bad. See, the good thing that comes out of it is their consciousness has expanded. They could stay childlike and naive in the garden forever and ever. But to be a human being is to take on a different quality. And it's a very dangerous and a blessed quality. See, it makes us in Jewish tradition higher than the angels. Why? Because we got to balance these two things. We are human and spiritual at this very same time. Angels, they just get to flap their wings and off they go. We got to balance the two inside of us. And so consciousness comes, but it's at the price of the innocence. We lose the innocence, but we are on the way to potentially greater maturity. So, you know, what happened? The story starts with that original sense of wholeness, and it ends with a sense of separation. The wounding is our relationship with the self. And Edinger points out that when young kids first learn to start to draw themselves with crayons, what do you look like? Draw me a picture of yourself. They draw in circles. They don't draw stick figures. They draw in circles. And what the psychologists tell us is originally children think of themselves as whole, as round, you see? And it's only in time that they come to differentiate the parts of self. See? In the beginning, all is whole, all is round. I'm going to do one more story now, and this is the Greek story. You may be familiar with it. It's the story of Icarus. So Icarus and his father Daedalus are on an island, and there's no way for them to get off. They're trapped there. But the old man has a plan, and what he does is he fashions a set of wings, both for himself, a set for himself, and a set for his son Icarus, and he makes these out of wax. Very, very thin. And he tells his son, now you put these on, but what? But don't fly too high. Do not get yourself too close to the sun. For if you do, the wax will melt. In other words, know your limits. Respect your limitations. I'm telling you what they are. And of course, you know what the kid does, eh? He gives in to the temptation to inflate. All right. And dreams about flying are generally dreams about inflation that the unconscious is trying to warn us of. When you're getting on an airplane in your dream, think of old Icarus there, hey? So it's that temptation to take on too much. Teenagers, think of Icarus as a teenager. So when I was a teenager, I was stealing my parents and my grandparents' cars, and I was driving fast and didn't have a wreck, unlike Icarus, because that's what happened to him. He flies fast, he gets close to the sun, and boom, down he goes into the sea. Hopefully we survive those adolescent temptations. But many times we carry those into adult life and we are thrill seekers. What can I get away with? Let me tempt fate with this one, eh? And so I'm reading this book, and actually I had just gotten up to the part about Icarus and what happens to him. And I was down in Florida and I was visiting a couple of friends down there, young guys who were in recovery. And I had been their counselor when they were in treatment several years prior. And they had gone into business together and they had made a lot of money. They did really, really well. And so I was in town and they wanted to take me out to dinner. And of course, they wanted to impress me. And they took me to a very fancy restaurant. Order anything you want, you know, go for it. And during the course of the meal, one of the guys said to me that he had bought an airplane, but it didn't really go fast enough, and he was planning to buy a new one, wanted one that could go faster. And so there I am, and I'm reading this book, you know, and I just finished the tale of Icarus. And here's this guy saying this. And I go out to the car and I give him the book. And I said, you know, hey, please read this. And I don't know if he did or not, but I did learn later that he got that airplane and he didn't know how to fly it, not sufficiently well. And it crashed, and he never walked again. I saw the myth, the unconscious myth lived out through his life. So what's the lesson from this first chapter in Edinger? Well, I think it's that we are going to inflate, that we can't avoid it. I sometimes give the example, if I'm given 6 green lights in a row when I'm driving down a highway, I start to inflate. I start to feel, well, finally, the universe is responding. Finally, they know who's driving this car, you know? Give me 6 red lights and I'm going to experience something else, eh? And so this is the human condition, see? And we have to learn to watch ourselves. We have to learn how to read what's going on inside of us. And this is so important for step 10, that I watch for these inflations, either getting too big or getting too small. You're not going to be able to avoid them, but we can spot them and we can bring them into consciousness. And we can make the unconscious conscious. We can ask God for help. We can talk about it with other people. We can even laugh at ourselves, hey? But we'd better watch. So Edinger closes his chapter with a poem from Lao Tzu, and I'm going to do the same, because it kind of captures this inflation, deflation activity that's going on in everybody. And what Lao Tzu wrote was this: he who feels punctured must once have been a bubble. He who feels unarmed must once have carried arms. He who feels belittled must have been consequential. He who feels deprived must have had privilege. So this is the journey that we have to go down before we go up. Jung once said, those who have a hard time finding God probably haven't looked low enough. I think we find him through the pain. We find him through the suffering. He meets us there. And Robert Johnson has a lovely line about boiling in the oil of transformation, that this is how the transformation happens. Rohr says something, Richard Rohr says, two things powerful enough to change a person, prayer and pain, and most of us, he says, choose pain. So I hope this isn't too deep. I know it's some heavy stuff, but I just can't think of anything more important if you're ready to really kind of grow spiritually than to begin understanding depth psychology and what it has to offer us on our spiritual journey. So again, hope it was helpful, and I hope you will keep coming back. God bless. Take care.